Okay, so everybody over here, this is Scott, who organized the entire EFF track this year. He's just totally awesome. Thanks for having me. I'm Annalee Newitz. I am the policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation in San Francisco. And I'm also a big fan of fanfic, which I don't know what that makes me, like a meta fan or something like that. But I don't actually do any fanfic myself, although I obsessively read other people's. So what I want to talk to you guys about today is go over some of just the basics that you need to know if you're going to be doing fan websites, if you're going to be doing fan fiction, if you're going to do machinima, if you're going to do fan TV, fan movies, anything that where you're taking characters or stories or ideas from pop culture and making them into your own. How many people here write fanfic? Yay! How many people read fanfic? That's a little bit more. People are like kind of nodding like, well, I kind of do. Does anybody have a fan website where they have photos from movies or TV shows? Okay, cool. Great. And is anybody doing like their own fan movies about stuff? Great. One person. Awesome. So I don't know if you guys know, but there's a ton of really amazing Star Trek fan movies and TV shows. There's one that's been going for like 7 seasons, and so those are really great. So let me give you a few scenarios, and then we can just open this up to conversation, because I think it'll be easier if folks can ask questions and I can answer. So I just want to kind of go over like 3 typical fan creation scenarios and what the legal implications are. So if you're doing fanfic or fan movies or any of these things, the area of law that you're most concerned about are copyright and trademark. And you want to make sure that you're not infringing copyright and you're not violating the trademark for the worlds that you're using or for the characters. So let me give you a first scenario, which is, say, for example, I'm just going to pick on Star Wars because it's easy. Say you have a Star Wars website. You have, like, you know, the Sith fan club website.com or something like that. Or like SithsAreHot.com. Actually, there probably is SithsAreHot.com. Are you Sith or not? Yeah. Actually, that would be an easy one, because it would be clearly not violating very much at all. So you have this fan site. So the 2 things you're going to be concerned about are, am I violating copyright on the photographs that I have? But also, am I violating trademark law around the Star Wars franchise? So the trademark part is very easy, and this applies across the board anytime you're doing a site or doing fiction or whatever that's related to a franchise. Just have a disclaimer. And people will tell you, disclaimers don't work. Well, they don't work as well with copyright issues, but with trademark issues, if you have a big disclaimer that says, I am not affiliated in any way with LucasArts or Star Wars or whatever, or whatever your franchise is, I'm not affiliated with Farscape, and whoever owns Farscape, is it Paramount or something? Henson. So I'm not part of that. The reason why is because the main thing that lawyers are going to be concerned about with trademark is something that's called initial interest confusion, which means if someone visits your site and they are initially confused and think that it actually is the official site of LucasArts or Henson or Paramount, that's when liability issues come up. So the disclaimer pops that bubble right away. No one could be confused, because you've said right up front, this is not affiliated. This is going to be, you know, stories about characters that you don't know, or, you know, characters having sex who never have sex on the show or whatever, if you're doing Slash. But this is pictures. So that's one thing to know right away. So you're pretty safe with trademark. And again, I should say that all of the examples here I'm going to give have to do with non-commercial sites, because I'm assuming that if you're doing fan stuff that you're not doing it for money, or if you are, it's extremely small, and like maybe you're selling chapbooks here at the con, but you're not, you know, selling great volumes of video cassettes from your website and stuff. So if you're getting into commercial stuff, maybe we can talk about that a little bit later, but that's gonna put you in a different position. So as long as it's free, all your trademark stuff is fine with the disclaimer. So then let me move on to the copyright issues if you have photographs. One thing that's really interesting is copyright law wants you, if you're reusing someone else's work, The lawyers basically would want to see you doing something very, very transformative with the photographs. And this is actually a term that's used in copyright law. There's almost a feeling of if you're working hard on the stuff to create a new work, then you're not going to be deemed liable necessarily for infringing copyright. So let me give you an example. Say you've taken a bunch of screenshots from Star Wars Episode 3, the worst episode ever. But just say you have. So first of all, by taking the screenshots, you're doing work. You're not just grabbing somebody else's photographs off of an official site. Second of all, the way that fair use law works, does everybody know what fair use is? You all have, even though there are copyright laws that say you cannot copy other people's works, there are also fair use exemptions to those laws. And so that means that you can make fair use, that's what we call it, of other people's work. And so there's certain ways in which you qualify for making a fair use of something. And one of the ways that you qualify is if you're using just a tiny little piece of their work. And a screenshot from a movie is a very tiny piece, particularly if you include a lot of commentary with it to show that you're using that photograph in the context of a work that you're creating as a fan. So for example, if you say, "This is my favorite picture from this scene because it shows the transformation in this character when he's gone from being like just a sort of bad actor to being a really bad actor." Wow, look at his makeup and the lighting. Because in that sense, what you're doing, and again, this is another fair use issue. Like I said, if it's transformative, if the work is transformative, you're less likely to be infringing copyright, because one of the big rules in fair use is a transformative use of a work is fair use. And basically what they're saying with that law is be creative. The more creative you are, the more your use of that work is fair, the less likely you are to be infringing copyright. however, with our photo site, a big no-no would be just taking photographs from the LucasArts site and slapping them on your website and with no commentary at all. Because first of all, if you're taking photographs from the site, just to get back to that issue about how much of a piece of that original work you take, if you take those photographs, you're taking an entire work, right? That photograph is so you're taking 100% of someone else's work, sticking it on your site, and you're not transforming it at all. So infringement. That is flat out infringement. You will get a takedown notice if they find it, which they probably will. How many people here have actually gotten takedown notices for anything they've done? Okay, so one day you may get a takedown notice. And that's usually when the entertainment company that owns the rights to the work that you're playing with just sends you a nasty gram and says, "Take it down or we'll sue you." So take it down or call us at EFF if you think that what you're doing is fair use. We would love, love, love to have a case like that of fan fiction or a fan website. So don't be afraid to call the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Okay, so here's my scenario too. Say you have a fan site and you have modified photos or pictures of characters from a book or from a movie. You're pretty safe with that. As long as you, again, have your disclaimer, so you don't claim that you're with LucasArts or something like that. But if you have, there's a lot of sites out there that have, you know, "Here's my romantic rendering of Obi-Wan," and it's drawn, you know, it's not something that's taken from the film. It's like a picture of Obi-Wan in front of a starscape or something like that. Again, because that's transformative, it's very, very, very clearly fair use. I don't think anyone's going to claim that you're infringing copyright, particularly if you have that disclaimer, so there's no trademark concern. There's another issue with using logos. I think you get into hot water if you actually use the logo of a franchise, like if you had like the Star Wars, you know, kind of trademarked logo with the, you know, that particular font that they use. Same thing for Star Trek. So if you use the font, but you use it to do other things, or if you use the logo and again you have like a really big disclaimer underneath, I think you're fine. But you want to be sure that there's some, if you use the logo, there's some transformation of it in some way. Again, be creative. Same thing with using characters, by the way. I think this comes up a lot where people are scared about using trademark characters or copyrighted characters. As long as they're transformed, as long as there's a clear disclaimer, you're fine. So obviously with something like Harry Potter slash fiction, which we were talking about in the hallway, in which I'm kind of a fan of. Yay, Harry Potter slash fiction. Yeah. Yeah, that would be funny if there was some argument that it was actually infringement, because, of course, all those things were really happening in the books.
I was going to ask, how do you define slash exactly?
Scott was there in the hall when we were having this debate. So how do we define slash? Well, is there a slash writer in the audience who wants to define it? How about you over there? So that,
and depending on how old school you are, and how it, some people will say, I feel that it deals with homoerotic relationships that are not canon. If it's a gay relationship in canon, what you have is queer fan fiction, not slash.
But what is in canon? You mean
it's an actual relationship?
Oh, right. If it's an actual, yeah, it has to be exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it has to be Tara and Buffy or something like that. Okay, good. Yeah, so the classic example of slash fiction is Kirk and Spock getting together and running the Enterprise in a loving and happy way. Yeah, it's sort of the oldest one, and it was K slash S, and women were doing it. It was mostly women back in the day. We're doing it as early as the early 70s. There's a great article by Joanna Russ, who's like the world's greatest science fiction writer ever. none of you have heard of her. But anyway, so she has a great essay about it. There definitely is, yeah. So in fact, people will often rate it because that way you know what you're getting into. So it'll be, you know, KS fiction, G rated, and it'll just be love between Kirk and Spock. But I'll have to say, everyone now knows what Spock's penis looks like because it's so commonly depicted. So there is X rated as well. Yes, that's an interesting issue. That's not going to affect anybody who's doing slash fiction. That was a very strange case. And I don't actually know what's going on with it, but pretty much it's very, very likely to get thrown out because it's...
an argument that had become public domain because they never tried to fight the public usage of it.
Exactly. So it had sort of fallen into public use. So... I don't think fans need to worry about using that rating system for now. But yeah, it's extremely... the rating system gets used so many places, it would be so easy to bring just like a giant stack of evidence to court. So I'm not even sure that may have settled. I'm not sure where that case is. So yeah.
It's like the MPAA would also only be able to force that on motion pictures, not on alternative media. Like,
which would be a transformative.
Yeah, it would be a transformative use. Thank you. Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right, because what we're talking about is an initial interest confusion. Is, you know, people will think it's...
for a trademark violation, not even copyright. So.
Mm-hmm, that's right. See, excellent. I'm so glad that you guys are already using these terms. Okay. I know. Fans are smarter than lawyers. Well, they're smarter than entertainment lawyers, that's for sure. So I guess like my final scenario that I wanted to go over really quickly, and then I think we should just chat, is the fan fiction scenario, which we sort of already touched on, which is the only thing you really need to be worried about is if you're writing fan fiction and you're not transforming the work enough. So if, for example, you do something like The Phantom Edit, which is an interesting example because it's the same. Do people know what The Phantom Edit is? It's The Phantom Menace with Jar Jar edited out. You can find it. You can find it in your friendly local interweb store. No, you can find it on BitTorrent, I think, still. So, but the thing that's interesting about that as an example is that it's the same exact film. It's The Phantom Menace, but with one element changed. Only less terrible.
That would serve the public interest.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's not a defense against copyright infringement. Yes, I have transformed this work for the better. Yeah, well, I think a lot of fans know that they're transforming the work for the better. So, unfortunately, that isn't a defense. So, there actually has been no court case around the Phantom edit. However, I think if it did, I think probably LucasArts is just, they don't care, or they think it's funny or something like that. Yeah, actually, I don't think they could have been, though, since he then showed up in the subsequent films. So, although not quite as much, thankfully. Yeah. Yeah. Did anybody see there's a comic book collection that was all these fantasies about Jar Jar? It was like an indie comic, and it was Jar Jar as an abusive father, and like Jar Jar as like a alcoholic, and it was pretty great. So that would be a transformative use of Jar Jar. Whereas the Phantom edit, I think, if you were to produce something like that, because you were only changing one element, that would be called a derivative work. Which is different. So a derivative work is sort of the opposite of a transformative work, where a transformative work, you've done something creative with the original story or the original characters. You're right in the territory of fair use there because you've created your own original work. Whereas a derivative work is so heavily dependent upon the original that you really can't claim to have done enough creatively with it to transform it. And some of them, like, the Phantom edit would be an interesting case because it would be, you could claim that editing itself is very creative. And a lot of the machinima stuff, which are movies made out of video games, like the Red versus Blue stuff, really are quite transformative. Even if they're taking clips from the video game, they've obviously completely, using editing and voiceovers, they've totally transformed the original work. So, yeah. I think that would be, yeah, I think that would clearly be transformative. However, you could see an argument on the other side. And that's what's interesting is there's never been a legal case about fan fiction or about fan works like this. Usually what happens is an entertainment company will go to a fan, you know, and say, take down this stuff off the web or I'll sue you. And the fan says, oh, okay, because fans don't have the money to fight large Hollywood companies, which is why if any of you are engaging in fair use activity and you get one of these takedowns and you believe that you are making fair use, please come to EFF because we would love to take your case for free and defend you.
This happened to a very good friend of mine. Warner Brothers went after her and shut her down. She was afraid of losing it and everything. Her work was music videos from a TV show.
Uh-huh. Huh, that was interesting.
And they shut her down, and we honestly think it's because they were jealous because her videos were better than the ones they were. She had no one to go to. Are you going to give us like an address, a phone number, something?
Yeah, actually, well, so the Electronic Frontier Foundation, our website is www.eff.org. There's a phone number on the website you can call. You'll talk to a really cool person named Allison, who's our legal intake coordinator. And tell her what's going on, and she'll bring your case to our lawyers, and either our lawyers will represent you, or they'll find a local person that can that is either free or very reasonably priced. But we do all of our legal work at EFF pro bono, which means we don't charge anything. So, and we have a pretty large staff of lawyers. So there we are. Thank you. I don't have the general number, actually, is 415-436-9333. And then it's 415-436-9333. And that'll just put you to the general line, and then it'll tell you the person you want to talk to is Allison Navone. Here, I'll write that down, too.
If you're being sued,
If you're being sued for being a fan.
What is sued for fan fiction? Press one.
For Anne Rice stalking victims, please press pound now.
Wow. Poor Anne Rice. When I heard about the disaster in New Orleans, I kept thinking, oh, poor Anne Rice. Her house is totally screwed now.
She already moved.
Did she already move?
Yeah.
Oh. She hasn't lived there for a while.
Is she in New York now?
I'm
like, okay, well, whatever then. Well, then I care more about all the other people. Okay, so that's Allison Navone is the person that you'd want to talk to. She's our legal intake person. So, yeah, definitely call us because it's exactly the kind of case that we would love to have because we want to have good case law. So the only two cases out there, just for your information, that deal in any way with these issues around derivative versus transformative work, which is really what you're talking about, there was a case with in the mid-90s when 2 Live Crew did their version of the song Pretty Woman. And it was kind of, in a weird way, it was like slash fiction because they took this old song, Pretty Woman, which is this kind of cheesy song about some pretty girl, and they made it dirtier. So they sexed it up and they changed it. And the court ruled, and so they were sued, and the court ruled that it was a parody and therefore fair use. So here's another piece of legalese to add to your vocabulary, which is parody is one kind of a transformative use of a work. And parody is, it's kind of strange, but the way that parody is defined within the law is when you use aspects of the work to make fun of the work. So in other words, if you use elements from Star Trek to make fun of Star Trek. Satire, on the other hand, is if you use elements of Star Trek to make fun of the president. So you use a work to make fun of something else, okay? And satire is very, very hard to defend as fair use for reasons that are really kind of unfair. So we don't have any good cases on the books with satire being used to defend fair use, but we have good case law on parody with this 2 Live Crew case. The other case that was really important was a few years ago with The Wind Done Gone, which was a transformative work that was basically a rewriting of Gone with the Wind. Thank you. Sorry. If it's not science fiction, I don't know it. It was basically Gone with the Wind retold from the point of view of a black character. And again, the defendant won based on the fact that it was a parody again. So it was a transformative use of the work, and it was parody because even though it wasn't particularly funny, she was using the original work to sort of make a comment on. She was, well, it wasn't social commentary, though. It was commentary on the original work, right? So she was using elements of Gone with the Wind to comment on the social politics of the original book. So again, that's why it's not satire. Even though, look, we all know it's satire, right? We all know it's sort of making fun of society generally, but the way that the court was able to interpret it as fair use was to understand that what the author was doing was making fun of the original work using elements of the original work. So that's what made it fair use. So if you can argue somehow that, and I think with fan fiction, it's very easy to say, well, I'm using the original work to make a comment about it. So I'm writing about Harry Snape, having a romance in order to sort of comment on the sexual tension in the books or something. Yeah.
What about when you start bouncing between, say, Star Wars and Star Trek?
Crossovers?
Crossovers, does that fall into satire because you're using another work to make comment about the other?
No, I think it would fall under parody, and I think you could also just argue that, again, it was transformative. So the reason why I brought up those are the only two cases we have, and they did revolve around the idea of parody, but there's other ways that you can make transformative use of a work, too. You can simply just say, this is a new work. It's clearly not the same thing as, especially when you're crossing, I think that would make it safer. My favorite cross was I saw some Blake 7 Buffy slash, which was really bizarre. But, you know, that's clearly creative because who would have ever imagined.
Well, Multiverse 2005, there's crossovers galore on that.
Yeah, so. Enterprise and what? Oh no! No, the only literally. No, you would not get sued twice. Basically, what would probably happen is if someone really was going to try to sue you for crossover, which I like I said, I think it's super unlikely because of the fact that it's so clearly transformative. Is probably either both of the companies, like both of the content holders, would get together and sue you together. So it would just be one suit. That would be great. So, I don't see that being as risky because I think it would be so clear to anyone reading it that it wasn't the original work because there was this weird cross. Although it might be different if you were using comic book characters, since comic books do actually have lots of crossovers and you often have a character from one. I mean, it's always within the same, like Marvel universe or something like that, but you do get, you know, Wonder Woman kind of wandering into other comic books and things like that. Why is Wonder Woman here? she's brought her rope and she's ready for some slash. So those are my basic examples, and now I just am curious to know. I have another note here. Oh, does anybody want to hear about the issue around commercial and non-commercial at all? Is that relevant for anybody? Does anybody want to? Yes, no. Yes? Okay. So the thing that's interesting with commercial versus non-commercial is, if you're non-commercial, you're fairly protected if you're not selling anything or if you're only selling under the radar, like at cons and things like that. Because if you're non-commercial, so a lot of copyright law looks at market competition. So when you're looking at something being fair use, one of the ways in which a court will determine if it's fair use is if it does or does not interfere with the marketability of the original work. So if your KS fiction is somehow interfering with Paramount's ability to market Star Trek, yeah, exactly. Or to market their novels. Like, for example, is it interfering with, like, Peter David's series, which is, you know, or something like that. They could claim, you know, let's just pretend that they're claiming that even though it sounds silly. If it's non-commercial, obviously they can't argue that it's interfering with Peter David's novels being sold because you're not selling anything. But let's say you are selling it. Say you have a website and you're selling your slash fiction to people on the website and you get sued. So the interesting thing is it really actually places you in quite a terrible position because if you're non-commercial, the burden is on Paramount, the copyright holder, to prove that you are undermining their market, which is pretty hard to do. But if you're commercial, the burden is on you to prove that you're not undermining their market. So you have to basically prove a negative. You have to prove somehow that your slash fiction isn't undermining their ability to sell Peter David novels, which is really, really hard. I guess the message is be as non-commercial as you can if you're going to be doing fan fiction or if you're going to be doing fan sites, because it's very easy for the entertainment companies to involve you in expensive litigation if you're being commercial. That's when you're the most vulnerable. It's not commercial, I believe, to have things like Google AdWords on your site. It could be argued, but I doubt that because that isn't really going to undermine the marketplace for the original work. So, like I said, I think if you're selling the fanzines at a conference, like for cash and stuff like that, I don't think it's going to be a problem because you're not being terribly public about it. If you're selling them on your website, it is a danger that you will be classified as commercial. Even as silly as it sounds, even if you know you're selling these for $2 and it's clear that they're, you know, I would say then be really clear on the website about that. Say, you know, this is a nonprofit operation. This is just to cover expenses.
Maybe even itemize your expenses.
Yeah, or also say things like, you know, if you're willing to trade with me for an equal, you know, amount, because like a lot of people will do that with zines, they'll trade zines. So if you show that you're basically, you're just doing it to cover costs, that is going to help a lot. it doesn't mean that in a lawsuit, they wouldn't bring that up as an issue, but it would allow your representation, your lawyer, to say, look, it says right here, it's just to cover costs. This is not an effort to undermine the market for the original material. It's clear that this person just literally wants to not have to pay for Xeroxes or to pay for printer paper. So I think you're safe then. I think the only problem is gonna be if you are like selling your fanfic with a nice cover for like, you know, $14.95 or whatever a Star Trek novel costs these days, which sounds, it's not $14.95, is it?
No, it's like
$6.99. Okay, that's good.
Yeah,
so you don't want to have like a comparable price and a product that looks really similar.
Structuring it so that you have a website that has a maximum fee and has one of the benefits of membership is fan books published.
That's interesting. Hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's really hard.
It's going to be a gray area. It's something that
it'd be really hard to prove that the money that you're paying actually creates the work and is therefore you know part of that entire situation.
It's a long court case.
Well, this is how they got around it for me. They gave me a password to certain sections, maybe only like two or three sections on the website in the actual zine, so you couldn't get the password via email or something like that. You couldn't get onto the website with the password for the members-only sections until you actually got the physical zine in the mail.
So were the members-only sections just, once you got there, it was just free fiction, or did you...
It wasn't fiction so much as it was, like, chat rooms, mm-hmm. like the editors, because they didn't want
okay.
to...
Okay.
That's the reversal of what I'm talking about. Yeah, okay. For that, you paid the magazine, and it got you access to the web.
Yeah, the web was second.
Yeah. It sounds like if you, so Randall's, yeah, what the service that she's describing, I think, is probably a little bit safer, because then it's kind of like, well, then the question would be the magazine, really, because you're paying for the magazine. In Randall's example, it sounds to me like what would be happening is that you'd still be basically paying for the magazine. You're paying to get access to content, right? So, again, it's hard to say what a court would do with that. I think that what the plaintiff would do, because the plaintiff is going to be your giant, mean entertainment corporation with, like, big fangs and stuff, and they would be saying, you know, this is commercial. On the other hand...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think what the defendant would do, the fan and the fan's great lawyer would say, well, how is this undermining your market for your books? You know, a website that someone can visit with chat rooms. So that would be the question, and then the judge would have to decide. And that's what's always, Well, you're always at risk with that. I mean, you're always risking that you're going to get a judge who's lousy, or or who is just completely convinced that copyright holders should never be allowed to, or they're just convinced that any transformation of copyright is dangerous for the copyright holder. So it's a risk.
Somebody throw water on him.
Yeah, me too. I'm jealous. Give me more sleep. So are there other questions about that stuff? Yeah.
Actually, I have a question regarding your own fan fiction. Most of the fan fiction, you know,
lot of it that I've read, authors will take their own characters and mix them with the characters from the original pieces of work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and oftentimes they'll write stories that are fairly well written, fairly good. How would an author go about protecting his or her own work as it's blended with the fan work, for fun, not mm-hmm. to be sold, but and post it on the web where it's open for anyone to read and take and use as they please,
So the way copyright law works in the U.S. right now, for better or worse, is that as soon as you publish something under your name, it's copyrighted to you. So you are now protected by the same copyright that Paramount has, but it's for your own work. Because your work is probably, it sounds like what you're describing, with the new characters and all that, I would say it's substantially transformative. So I don't think the only reason why your work wouldn't be protected would be if it were found to be infringing someone else's copyright, in which case your work would be unlawful and too bad. So I think, as long as you publish it, you can, if you like, you can put a little copyright symbol with your name. I also encourage people to find out about, there's a new form of copyright license you can get. It's called a Creative Commons license. If you go to creativecommons.org, there's a great little cartoon that walks you through it. And Creative Commons licenses are great for fans because, unlike traditional copyright, which is all rights reserved, Creative Commons licenses are some rights reserved. And you can actually build into your copyright license allowing other people to make use of your work. But you can stipulate things like you can say, well, you can use pieces of my work as long as you attribute them to me. Or you can say, go ahead and use any part of my work. And then there's no danger that somewhere down the line, somebody will be sued for using a piece of your work because you've already put it out on a license that says, go ahead and use pieces of this in your own fan fiction. I really highly recommend visiting creativecommons.org and finding more out about that. So it's the perfect fan license. Thank you.
Well, you answered my first question, which is if you need to change the copyright notice when you're doing that. But on the subject of commercial works, how does somebody like Red versus Blue, for instance, deal with that in that they release the work both for free on their website and then they sell a DVD compilation of it? Are they in danger from being sued by Bungie for McKinima?
So the Red versus Blue question is interesting. They have permission from Microsoft to do what they're doing. And they did not initially. I actually was just chatting with one of the guys from Red versus Blue because they're here in the dealer's room. And they got permission from Microsoft. Microsoft loves it. Microsoft actually now pays them to do little convention videos for them and all kinds of stuff. And so that's actually a case where the copyright holder was very happy. And so they're in luck. You're probably not going to be so lucky in other cases. And perhaps another kind of use of, so if you had Red/Blue, I don't know how happy Microsoft would have been about that. yeah. So you guys. Okay, please go out and do it. So that would, and the thing that would be really fantastic about that is that it would be slash fiction based on Machinima, which is already itself a fan work. So it would be a transformative use of a transformative use of an original work. So
Red versus Blue and Microsoft and Bungie would be saying.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. But we could go ask those guys right now. We could be like, is it okay if we do some slash fiction based on Red and Blue? Yeah, I'm sure they'd love that.
How do I get this damn armor off?
I'd like that idea. So go ahead and do that.
So I'm going to approach this from the other side. I'm actually, I'm a game developer myself. I have my own game. How can I arrange it so that, I can allow people to use my, for example, say I want somebody to use my logo, my game's logo on a website, but obviously I still want to have control of that. What would be a good way to handle that?
So there's no Creative Commons trademark licenses right now. But you could, I mean, you could certainly have something to that, you could actually write something up to that effect and have it on your website and say, like, feel free to use this logo as long as you're doing it for non-commercial purposes or something like that. And certainly for your work as a whole, for the video game that you have, you can also put that under a Creative Commons license and say, yes, you can copy pieces of this, but only for not. There is actually specifically a Creative Commons license, which is a non-commercial license, which is you can make as much use of this as you like without asking permission as long as it's for non-commercial use, which is exactly what fans are doing. They're making non-commercial use of the original work.
Yeah. On a trademark, what they did was they basically they took and they copied the trademark, the original creator, and they specifically modified it for the purpose of allowing other people to use the trademark, which was still recognizably derived from the original.
Mm-hmm.
But it's obviously it's kind of like using a different color ink.
Yeah.
And it's like obviously this came from here. But this is the public use version of it.
Yeah. So that's one way to do it. The other thing is, now remember, I mean, this is all about you, the trademark holder. So the other thing you can do is just not go after people who are using your trademark. So it's just like what we were saying with Red versus Blue. Microsoft could have really pounded those guys. Instead, they chose not to. So one way to allow people to use your logo and to use your copyrighted materials is simply to let them do it. The thing that's the advantage of Creative Commons licenses is you tell people up front, go ahead and use this. You don't have to ask permission. So in a way, what you're doing is you're encouraging people to make creative use of your work, which I think is great. And I don't think people should have to live in fear that if they're going to use your trademark, that they'll be slapped with some kind of takedown notice.
My publisher claims trademark on the use of the camel with the Perl programming language. But they've made it a clear policy that although they reserve all rights, if you approach them to use it in a particular way that won't offend or dilute the trademark, they will give in writing permission for you to use it. So they've kind of gone the middle route there that's maintaining full control, but on a case-by-case basis, they then release it for zero cost.
There's a lot of publishers that do stuff like that, where it's as long as you approach them and you ask, you can use it. I prefer the other method because the thing about fair use is just fair use is, in fact, unauthorized use. That's one of the definitions of fair use is that you make use of that work without asking permission first. And that I believe that encourages more creativity and more innovation because you don't have to have the labor of trying to find out who to ask, particularly when you're working with, I mean, O'Reilly is different because they're a very responsive and nice publisher, but you know, if you're trying to get permission from Tor or from, you know, some or Paramount, you know, good luck. They're going to say no, too. That's the thing is when I was putting together a book that I just did on monster movies and I did stills from a bunch of films, my lawyer said, my EFF lawyer said, don't ask permission because it's better case for fair use if you don't ask permission and you use it. And this was in the context of a book. So, you know, talk about commentary, right? There's like tons of commentary and then like 8 screenshots. So I think we're pretty safe. But, you know, it's interesting that not asking permission is actually the way to go. So she had her hand up.
Should fan fiction writers use disclaimers? I mean, you said that it didn't do much good, but if you say, hi, this doesn't belong to me, it belongs to these executives and that distributor, and I'm not making money off of it, is that still a good idea?
No, what I said was actually definitely use disclaimers.
Okay.
Disclaimers will do you a world of good when you're talking about trademark. So anything to do with trademark, if you have a disclaimer, they cannot get you.
So even if it is mostly, if it is more a copyright issue with fanfic, it's still a good idea to have
this. It's still a good idea to have a disclaimer, especially if you're using any, like, a logo or anything that could be. Remember with trademark, the big issue is the initial interest confusion. So if somebody looked at it and for just a moment they thought it was somehow connected with the original copyright holder, that's when that's the initial interest confusion, right? That's like, huh? You know, you just have to imagine someone having a moment of confusion. So that's what the disclaimer protects against. And disclaimers can also help with copyright too. Just the fact that you went and put it on there, that will definitely strengthen your case. So always use the disclaimer.
If you don't enforce your rights to a trademark, isn't there a chance that you're going to lose the actual use of that trademark if it's something you've produced?
There is that chance, yeah. Particularly if your trademark becomes something like, you know, Kleenex or Xerox. I mean, there's also the chance that you'll lose it anyway, which is the famous sort of Kleenex case where, and Xerox as well, where Coke still has a trademark on Coke, though. They might not have a trademark on Pop. But they certainly, Coke is trademark. Is that because it ran out, though? I don't think it's because it... People say... Not on Coke? Okay. Yeah. But they don't have Coke. All right. Yeah.
I remember reading about it because it's somewhat famous because it was one of the first examples.
Mm-hmm. It just passed into general use. Yeah.
And it's a commercial product. It finally got old enough to where the courts just said, look, you can't have it anymore because
it's a Coke.
Everybody that they lost.
No, it's Coke. Like if you go to the barbecue joint down the street from my house and you ask for a Coke, they'll say, okay, what kind? Because by Coke they know that you mean soda. And that's also a regional thing because Coke came from down here.
Yeah.
But there aren't any products out called Coke other than
actually Coke.
Like RC Cola, that's why I was asking.
Oh, you mean any other?
Yeah, people aren't using it in product names, but yeah.
Because what the people were using Handmade Science to say Coke, and Coca-Cola tried to say, well, no, you can't, and then the courts were like, knock it off.
It's kind of like Monopoly. Nobody's released another game with the same name, but they still lost their trademark because it's been around so long.
Yeah, and also Monopoly is a term that's used in economic theory, too, so.
Well, the trademark.
I know it's for the game, I understand. Yeah. So there is a danger, and that is one of the ways in which in a court if you were arguing that somebody had lost their trademark due to general use, like that would be something that you could say is like, well, look, you're not enforcing your trademark, so, you know, the fact that it's gone into general use means you've lost it. So, you know, if you're in a case like sort of what Brian was talking about where you know, you have a game and, you know, a few people use your trademark, I don't think you're in danger. But if a lot of people start using it, yeah. So that's why I think, you know, just to go back to what we were saying earlier, it's good to have the sort of have your trademark, but then have a disclaimer or something on your site where you say, feel free to use this trademark for non-commercial purposes. You can either contact me for permission or not. You can choose which one you want to do. Right. Yeah. And just spelling that out, you know, I mean, it sounds a little preposterous, but actually spelling that out will help you. That'll give you the rights that you've claimed in the same way that having that disclaimer really, really helps. So so you had your hand up for a long time. So.
I kind of wanted to do a follow-up to that because I was hoping you would talk a little bit about the difference between trademark and copyright in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's one thing that I have seen particularly with writers, published writers. This is what they say, why they say they don't allow fan fiction. They've been told, you know, by whoever, that they have to defend their copyright or they'll lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds like a trademark argument.
That's a trademark
to me,
issue,
which
yeah.
Seems different.
That's actually, they are different. With trademark, you do have, as folks were pointing out, you do have to defend it to maintain your hold over it, particularly if lots and lots of people are using it. I mean, it's kind of a special case where that's going to come up because usually with a trademark, there isn't a kind of general use of it. But you do have to defend it or you do have to lay claim to it. With copyright, you know, no. Copyright is yours for, you know, life plus 70 years. And no one can take that away from you, even though it might greatly enrich the public domain to take it away from you and help other people make wonderful creative works.
The recent Supreme Court decision
Well, no. Intellectual property is not the same as property, as we all know. You do not have to defend it. And that's why the Creative Commons licenses can exist, because you can say, you know, right up front with your license, I hold this copyright, but you can still use it without asking my, you can still use parts of my work without asking my permission, and I still retain those rights. So you, and then the woman in the back after that.
Okay. I'm friends with an author online, and she wrote a slash story, but the plot line she used was totally original. And she has had several people try to use that plot line, and she's gone after them herself and told them, you can't use that plot line. It is mine. If you want to use those characters, that's fine. They don't belong to me, but the plot line is mine. Is there anything that she can do as far as going on to Creative Commons and getting some kind of copyright of some sort for the plot line for that story?
So, no. The short answer is no, but the longer answer is, first of all, as somebody who's writing fanfic, I would hope that people writing fanfic would want other people to be using their plot lines and things like that, because part of the spirit of the community doing fan creativity is sharing. Yeah. And it's disappointing when a fan won't share in the same way that other fans are. But that's sort of an ethical issue. But then I think, but in terms of protecting a plot, people have tried to use copyright to protect plots, which is why, for example, the people who made the fine movie Clonus are suing the people who made The Island, another fine movie. Actually, Clonus is way better than The Island. And when I saw The Island come out, I was like, whoa, it's like a copy of Clonus. Why would anybody copy Clonus? It's a Clonus clone. So the people who made this film, and the plot between the two films is what's similar, right? They changed the character names and, you know, all that. But so you can try, you know, this author could try to bring a copyright infringement case, but why? You know, I mean, it just seems, you know, it's fine if he or she wants to write to the other authors and says, like, hey, you know, I really don't appreciate that. I think in the fan community, it should be kind of understood that people should share alike to the extent that they can, you know, without stepping on each other's toes, because that's the spirit of the thing. So,
what is the motivation for this author trying to protect that storyline?
The storyline that she wrote it's a Harry Potter / fanfic, and it deals with the Weasley twins opening up a whole new branch to their shop. You're probably gonna, if some of you have read it, you're gonna know who it is. Called the Weasley Wizarding Candies, and all the candies are erotic candies.
It's the aphrodisiac section.
Yeah.
Oh, now come on, she invented that and she thinks nobody's going to want to use that plot device? That's awesome. I was hoping it was going to be the Weasley sex toy division. The magical dildo. Yeah, that's actually really true. Yeah, sue J.K. Rowling. She's stealing from the fans.
But, you know, she's got, like, one of the candies. She doesn't really have a name for it, but she describes it looks like a Muggle lifesaver. And it's called a ringwormer. And whenever you're using these candies, whoever your heart's desire is feels it.
That's so awesome. I want to go out and write one of those stories right now. No, J.K. Rowling stole it. Didn't you follow?
Dealing with, you know, a slash piece with, like,
let me turn the question around. Does she have a commercial motivation? Because if she doesn't,
no,
there's probably nothing in the law that will help her.
She's not making any money off
she's
of it.
She's not being deprived of income by other people.
No,
right.
She's not.
And all of these laws deal with protecting money rights.
Yeah, and that's why I was like, you know, I told her I was coming here to this panel. She's like, ask to see if there's anything I can do. And I'm like, okay, I'll ask. I don't think there is.
Yeah, I mean,
I
most...
agree with Anna Lee, because I have a kind of a circle of friends on LiveJournal online. And we all write Babylon 5 fanfiction, and we steal from each other all the time. All the time, we steal from each other.
And of course...
What was this?
What?
Well, like, you know, one of my friends invented a word for the Centauri genitalia, and now we all use it. And it's just kind of an understanding.
What is it?
Brachiarte.
Okay.
We all use it. You know, one person invented it, and now we all use it. And we just kind of have this general understanding.
And that's just made language develop that way.
Yeah, and let's not forget, too, that, of course, Hollywood also, all the studios steal ideas from each other as well. So, I mean, this is...
They steal ideas from literature and...
Yeah, you know, especially and plot lines.
Five,
I mean...
Five asteroid movies in one summer.
Yeah. So, I think this is a, you know... And again, it's like, if you invent something that's, you know... Or let's say, you know, she thinks up something cool like the Weasley aphrodisiacs or the Weasley sex toys or whatever... you know, it's not surprising that other people would think that was great and want to run with it. And I think, you know, I mean, I think it should be viewed in the fan community as a compliment when other people do that. So hopefully she can come to see it that way instead of being so upset. Yeah, she needs to realize that's, I mean, because of the fact that people don't get paid in the fan community, what we get paid in the fan community is in adoration like that. You know, other people complimenting your idea, you know, by spreading your ideas around, that's kind of showing.
As long as people know where it came from.
Yeah, you, again, you can't, because if she then wants to insist on knowing where it came from, that's going to get her into all kinds of other tizzies. Because what if, you know, so I hear this idea and I'm like, oh, that's cool, I'll write about Weasley sex toys, and then somebody else writes about that, and then, but, you know, pretty soon nobody knows where it came from. So, plus, as you pointed out, it's in canon now, right? So everybody will just think it's from J.K. Rowling. So I think she should sue J.K. Rowling. Wouldn't that be awesome if she really was reading fanfic and had gotten the idea? That would be so cool. So there's a woman who's had her hand up for about a million years in the back.
This is kind of getting close to what I wanted to ask. If you take characters from a story and create your own little story using the characters and enough that you know it's who it is in the plot, but your story's original, and you're going along and having a good time and writing these fanfictions, and all of a sudden the real legitimate author finds out about it. And they come to you and say, you're writing fan fiction about my stories. We're going to do whatever, sue you for this. What do you do?
So what you do is call the EFF. Because at that point, you're getting a legal threat. So that's initiating a legal process. As soon as you get a threat that you could be sued, contact us, and our lawyers will protect you, or we'll get another lawyer in your area who will take the case. Because... you know, if you are making fair use, if you're doing something transformative with those characters, you have every right to do it. That is absolutely your right, particularly if it's a non-commercial purpose. So just remember that. I mean, this is the whole point, is copyright laws, and people forget this, are supposed to protect the public domain. They're not supposed to protect the people who, you know, are making tons of money on them. They're supposed to protect people like us who want to make creative use of all of these great stories that are out there. So as long as we're not trying to undermine somebody's business model, which I think does get into a different territory, if all we're doing is making very creative, transformative use of that stuff, you know, we absolutely legitimately can protect ourselves legally, and, you know, you have an excellent case. And like I said, it would be great to have a case like that on the books, because it would protect a lot more fans, and it would probably stop entertainment companies from hassling you as much. So yeah, call a lawyer.
And like what she was saying,
based on someone else's story, which I stole. What she's saying is she wants, it's kind of hypocritical, because the person that's saying, I want to copyright it, so you can't use my fan fiction, well, she stole that idea in the first place. She stole the characters in the first place. Not steal, you know what I mean?
Borrowed
it.
Well, let's use... Yeah, she transformed them. And this is a natural form of human sharing. I mean, we share stories, we transform the stories, and we use it to talk about, you know, all kinds of issues in our lives. And so, it's a natural state for us to be sharing. And I think that, you know, that's one of the troubles with copyright law is that it comes in and it tries to set up boundaries where we would naturally be sharing in a human environment. That's why I encourage fans to look at sharing plots and sharing stories as part of what they're doing. And so to not then duplicate the bad behavior of the copyright holders by saying things like, I'm going to copyright my thing now. The right reaction is not to try to fight the big copyright people with your own little copyright. The right move is to say, no, I'm going to share. And I'm going to share as much as I want because it's lawful for me to do that and because it enriches the story and you probably get a lot better stories out of it. Because as I said, we all know that fan fiction is often better than the original. So, particularly when it comes to things like Star Wars. So.
Specifically with this case, I'm not very clear, but it sounds like your friend is more upset with the idea of someone copying the actual item she has put in the sex shop rather than the idea of the aphrodisiac shop itself.
Well, it's unclear, right? We don't know. I think she's... Yeah, I think, the answer is chill. And the answer is, again, to look at it as a form of compliment, you know, that she had such a good idea that other people wanted. And it's in the same way that, you know, we compliment J.K. Rowling by doing fanfic about Harry Potter. It's a compliment. And, you know, in general, I think copyright holders, when they see fan work, see it that way. Which is why, you know, Joss Whedon goes on all the fan boards and is like, yay, I love fans, you know. So. Oh no, let's not have a Joss slag fest.
Okay, he's telling me to just start talking into the microphone.
Okay.
And this kind of goes back to something that was said earlier. What about vidding? Because when you're taking the clips, and that I think is commentary mm-hmm. on the original source material, but what about the use of the music? Because the recording industry has been... Rabid.
Both the recording industry and the motion picture industry have been. So again, it's going to come back to the same basic rule about transformation of the original work. It's also going to come down to as long as it's... So first we have to establish, is it non-commercial? Yes. Okay. So then, we hope it's non-commercial. So then it's, is your editing of the videos, is your commentary on the video enough to make it transformative? Generally, it is. I mean, there's a lot of vidding that really is transformative, and then there's people who make completely original films based on the source material. Like, there's this great Star Trek one called Starship Exeter, which is starshipexeter.com, which is so awesome. And they basically, like, they use all the original sounds from the music, the sets. And it's so, the cheese, yeah. And it took them like 10 years to make it. And it was so lovingly done, you know. And they do use the music, like I said, and the sounds, but it's so clearly transformative. I mean, it's new characters, everything, that I think they would be protected. So I think, you know, with vidding, it's going to be a balance. Like, how much work have you done to transform it?
That's why I'm asking you, because I don't think there usually is any work in actually transforming the music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's I think my real concern is because basically what they do is they do all the work with the visual material, and I mean clearly you're working with the music, but you're
right.
Not changing the song.
So but again,
you're
so
changing the interpretation of how the song is going to be viewed by putting the video with it.
And also remember that part of what we look at with fair use is how much of the original work you're using. So if the original work is motion picture, script, and music, If you're, the music is not looked at as a separate piece, right? You're using music from a, you know, a whole, or are you talking about doing a music video with someone else's song?
Right. Oh, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. You know, it's like
I think, yeah,
like something like they would have done at VividCon last weekend, where basically what you're doing is you're taking,
yes, and there actually have been cases with, yeah, with people doing music videos from taking video game characters and setting it to popular music, and they actually have gotten takedown notices for that. There was actually a post on Boing Boing about that a couple weeks ago. So
how defensible is that likely to be?
How defensible is that? Good question. The people who were threatened definitely took down their work. I think it would be hard. It would be, you'd have to say it was transformative, but you're not transforming the music. So you might be able, I think what you would want to claim is parody. And that you'd say, you know, coupled with the visuals, this is parody of the original song. And I think you'd have a good case. Yeah. You could argue. I mean, particularly like some of them. I mean, like you have like a love song with two characters in a video game who usually, well, there's one where there's like two characters from a video game who usually fight. I can't remember which game it was, but it was like a, you know, a hand-to-hand combat type game. And it sort of shows them dirty dancing together to a romantic song. It's really great, actually. It's really hilarious. And I think that would be, that could arguably be parody. So it would just depend on how you used it. So be careful.
Mm-hmm. Where people are taking songs and then they're taking the clips from the shows or the movies and creating a video out of them set to the song.
I think you'd have, I mean, I think you could claim that, yeah, I mean, that it was, you could make that claim. Whether it would win, I don't know. So again, it's definitely, like I said, the best thing to do if you're in that situation is contact the EFF, and we will help you and we'll give you advice. So
could you possibly get around that by including, like, with the link to the vid, like a short commentary on how you think the lyrics relate to the dynamic between the characters? And
good idea.
Could you use
very,
that?
Very, very good idea. Yeah, if you do that, that will definitely, definitely help. So if you have your own commentary explaining it, all to the better. The more commentary you can have, the more creative stuff you can have in there, the better off you are, the more it's clearly transformative. So that's a very good idea. Yeah.
You had made a comment before that the purpose of copyright is to protect the commons, the public, rather than the content creators, the commercial interests. It's been a long time since I read up on the history of copyright, like 25 years. It seems to me that it was always intended to strike a balance between those two. Could you respond to that?
I think it is intended to strike a balance between the two originally when copyright terms were 25 years. However, these days, I think people forget about that. So what I tend to do is emphasize the fact that copyright is there to protect the public domain. It's there to protect both the interests of the creator and the interests of the people who wish to use that material in the public domain. And I think, you know, we've been so brainwashed by big content into thinking that copyright is only there to protect the interests of the copyright holder that we forget that originally the founders wanted to protect the public domain and wanted everyone to have access to those creative materials, because that's the basis of innovation. We all know that, you know, we all know that deep down, but it's, you know, it's easy to forget when you get those trailers in front of movies that say, if you take my movie, you're stealing. And, you know, that's not necessarily true. Fair use says it's not. So. Yeah, exactly. Take the red pill. Yeah, that's a little different, though. You're not going to kill anyone if you make fair use. So she's had her hand up for a while, and then him. So.
I have a question about fan fiction, but about fan art.
Yeah.
Downstairs in the art room, I see so much of the fan art that's for sale in the art show for auction, and many of these things are just, you know, I've seen that picture. In print, I know it's a copyrighted picture that, you know, it's from the film studios. You know, somebody's drew a picture of Anakin Skywalker, and they're selling it, and they didn't even change the pose. You mm-hmm. know, it's just a pencil sketch that they had done, and they're selling it. Now, are they at risk for getting into trouble from Lucasfilm? Will they, you know? You think that's overstepping the boundaries? I know there's kind of a boundary mm-hmm. that, you know, between what you can do on a small, on a small scale mm-hmm. and what you can't do. Like at Celebration 2, there was a vendor who had done several sketches of Yoda and Stormtroopers, and he had them nicely copied, and he was signing them and selling them, mm-hmm. and he got in trouble.
So I would say, actually, you're pretty unlikely to get in trouble for that, because you have to, again, look at the issue around when you're looking at commercial stuff, you have to ask yourself, will this particular item substantially replace the market for the other item? The thing is that no one is going to buy a sketch of Anakin instead of watching the movie. So it would be hard. But she wasn't talking about a poster from the movie studio. She was just talking about a pose from the film, right? Was it?
Right. Well, there's certain publicity shots
yeah.
that you see that are fairly common. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of the artwork that I've seen down in the art show, you know, it's just basically the person sketched. They sketched a photo and they really didn't change it. I mean, it looked like they could have put it in a little light box mm-hmm. and traced it on the wall, you know.
It is transformative. The fact that it's commercial is going to make it a lot harder. So if Lucas decides, you know, he wants to sue this person, which probably they wouldn't do because, you know, it's for a good cause and it's, you know, it's for Dragon Con as a nonprofit, blah, blah, blah. However... Oh, I thought it wasn't for the charity auction?
No, it's for the individual artists down in the art room. The money goes to the artist.
Oh, okay. I thought she said the charity auction. So I would say it would be debatable. Again, it would be kind of at the discretion of the judge to decide if that went to court. You know, the judge would weigh the different issues. You know, is this a substantial replacement for the original? You know, and it would be, again, as I explained, the burden would be on, so say this artist is sued, so they're the defendant, right? So it would be on the burden of the defendant to prove that they were not undermining the market for the original poster or photograph. That's hard to prove, particularly if you're making $300 on it. So it would be difficult. However, it is a transformative use of the photograph. It's, you know, clearly different. No one's going to confuse the two things. So I think the defendant would have a good case. So I don't think that means that you should stop doing that kind of art. It might not be such a good idea to sell it for so much money. It might be better to make it available for very low cost or free. However, I do think that you'd have a good case that it was transformative. So. Yeah, so it's a difficult balance. It would be hard to, yeah.
I think the safest thing going for the artist in this case is it is a convention. It is relatively low under the radar.
It's very under the radar.
To get caught by anybody from Lucasfilm.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing is if they were selling it on the internet, they might really be in trouble. We need to wrap up. So maybe we can take.
I just wanted to say I think there's something that I would call the Google factor. It seems evident to me that a lot of the enforcement is being done by Google searches or others.
It's being done by crawls a lot of the time, yeah.
Or crawls, I guess that's another possibility. But again, if you're not on the internet and you're not obvious,
yeah, the old prawn trick.
If you're not as obvious, yeah, then. That doesn't necessarily affect the standing of your case, but it may be less likely that you would be targeted.
Yeah, I mean, definitely places like Dragon Con are safer because they are sort of below the radar. So, I mean, unless, you know, some of the film studios send spies here, which is not entirely outside the realm of possibility. You know, the entertainment industry recently paid the Los Angeles Police Department for they basically gave a donation to the Los Angeles Police Department earmarked it for surveillance cameras in certain areas of LA because they wanted enforcement on vendors who were selling bootlegged films on the street in LA. So don't put it past the entertainment industry to do crazy ass shit. Yeah, they're not going to go. I mean, so it's unlikely, but it's dangerous. So let's have a final question and then wrap up. She hasn't asked a question yet, so.
I created a comic character, and a guy from Australia wanted permission to use the character.
Uh-huh.
Is there any difference in copyright law internationally?
There is difference. There is a difference, yeah. Different countries do have different rules. Generally, when you're dealing with international issues, any country that's a signatory to the World Intellectual Property Organization's treaties, international treaties, will have to obey, you know, general copyright laws as we have them here. And in particularly with Australia, there's actually very, very similar copyright rules. So basically, if you are doing international copyright, if you're dealing with international copyright, you look to the WIPO treaties, the World Intellectual Property Organization. So generally, you're fine. All right, so we're going to wrap up now because there's another awesome panel coming up with Ilanka, who's right here.
You're a hard act to follow. That was great. I really enjoyed listening to that.
So just remember, be as creative.